Welcome to the Training Ground Guru podcast in association with Huddle. In every episode, we bring you insights into the teams behind the teams in professional football. Coming up on today's episode.
It was a really rare opportunity to get a football club of this size that was completely broken at the bottom of League Two and kind of make it your own. And that's the dream, really, to become the first manager with one football club to go from League Two to the Premier League.
I'm Simon Austin from Training Ground Guru, and this month we've got two guests on the podcast. They're Bolton manager Ian Evatt and his sporting director Chris Markham. Ian played in all four divisions before becoming a manager with Barrow in 2018. He led them back to the Football League for the first time in 48 years and has also been successful at Bolton, masterminding promotion to League One and winning the EFL Trophy. Chris was head of performance analysis at Huddersfield and game insights lead at the Football Association prior to joining the Trotters in February 2021. I sat down with the duo at the club's Tough Sheet Community Stadium ahead of the new season. It's rare to get a manager and sporting director speaking together like this, so we hope you enjoy it. Thanks very much for joining us on the podcast, Ian and Chris.
Yeah, thank you for having us. It's a pleasure.
And I know I interviewed you for an article a couple of years ago now, Chris, and you said when you came in it was starting from scratch, really. And I remember you said there was no player database, no scouting, I think. Analysis was hardly there. What kind of a state are you in now?
We're in a really good state. I think if I inherited a blank canvas, I'd dread to think what Ian inherited, obviously being nine.
You had to get the canvas.
Yeah, you had to buy the canvas, yeah. So, yeah, we're in a much better state now, and I think that's obviously credit to the board, first and foremost, for backing our ideas. You know, it was great, particularly, you know, I know Ian feels the same as me, but from can I speak from my perspective, to get a blank canvas at a club of this size is, you know, once in a lifetime, genuinely. And I know we both feel like that. And I think to then be allowed to put on that canvas what we want in our own way without having to change, manage anything that was previously here has obviously been a great opportunity for us. And we are getting tremendous support from the board, from everything. Obviously, the fans will see the sign-ins and everything that goes on the field. But there's a huge amount of stuff that's going on off the field, training grounds, staffing. You know, the staff that have been here with Ian since day one have been absolutely fantastic and pivotal on this journey as well. So we've been really well backed across all the departments, really, and that's continuing. You know, the initial focus was on players and making sure we're winning on a Saturday, and I think Ian's been phenomenal in delivering that when you look at where we've come from.
Yeah, I think that's the key part, really. You have to do things in stages. You can't do it all in one go. And fundamentally, the most important part of a football club is results on a Saturday. You can't do any of the things that we wanted to do without winning. So first and foremost, it was about getting a team that could function and can win football matches. That took time. And then off the back of that, we were able to then build a strategy, build a brand and identity that we want to follow. As I said, we're really thankful and grateful that Sharon and the board have put in their full trust in us. It's very rare that two relatively inexperienced people, not in terms of football in general, but in our specific roles. I've been a manager now for 5 years. Chris is new to his role.
Yeah.
So to have that trust is a one-off, as Chris said. So we're extremely grateful for that. And what we want to do is repay them in spades, really.
I think that's really interesting about like trying to do it in stages. Like you can't... Look, there are clubs that will come down into this league and try and do it in one hit. And I think it's a dangerous game, and it's one that we've been really conscious that we do want to do things in a different way. We've seen where the club was, and we never want it to go back there, and that's through direction of the owners and the board and the people that are looking after the club and the fans, you know, should always be at the forefront of our minds. But that doesn't mean to say we're not ambitious either. And I think, you know, we had a conversation the other day. We played a pre-season game behind closed doors against Bradford, and we were really pleased with our performance for most of the game. And Ian sort of brought, even to my attention, when you get caught up in the day-to-day, it was only 2 years ago that we were vying with them and they were one of our main rivals for promotion from League Two. And you think how far we've come. That's a big club like we are. You know, it's no slant on them. but it just sort of shows us the level of progress we have made. And sometimes, like, sitting down and having these conversations, it's actually good to bring that back to the forefront, because we're striving every day to get this club promotion, and sometimes you can put that too much pressure on yourself and not realise where we've come from. So it's about balancing the two, and I think, you know, we have a lot of good conversations around making sure that this is something that when we do get to the Championship, which we hope as soon as possible, we're in a position to thrive there. I know that's something Ian's spoke about a lot.
In terms of the recruitment, is the first step to get that game identity that you were talking about? So then you know the types of players you're after, how you want to play?
Yeah, I mean, I have a clear idea of what I want to do and how I want us to play and what that looks like as a team and as individuals. And I think what it does do possibly for Chris is really just gives you a clear sight on what's required, both in terms of the brand and identity, but in terms of what characteristics each player needs in one specific role. That then, you know, shortens or makes the pond a little bit smaller for us to be able to recruit. And sometimes also that's difficult, and Chris can go into some detail on that, but when you're trying to look at players that are playing in a completely different way, in a completely different system, you're basically looking for flickers of what we think that could translate into what we do. So it's challenging, but also makes things a lot clearer in terms of we do have a specific brand and identity, so we do our best to recruit to that.
100%. It's a blessing and a curse. I'll explain why. I mean, the blessing was when I first met Ian, we didn't know each other from before. We were put in contact with a mutual friend, and you know, we sat down and just first and foremost agreed on how we think the game should be played and what we enjoy and what we want to see and how we want to see it. And that was like the bit where I thought this has got a chance of being successful. And because of that, like Ian says, the blessing is it makes my job so much easier to recruit for, because I know what Ian requires from each of the positions. We speak a lot, you know, not just in the transfer windows, but about our performances and other games of other teams. We really share a lot of football detail and tactical discussion, which I think makes obviously my job then a hell of a lot easier, because particularly until the recent changes, obviously, we were only recruiting in this country. And so there's only a certain amount of players who are available to us. And we can then, with our, you know, with some knowledge and filtering, we can quickly remove some of them that we don't think fit the profile to play for us, whether that be age-specific or technical, physical, whatever that is. We can get to that point quite quickly. So then we can do more work on the ones that do fit our criteria. So that's, it's a huge blessing. However, the curse is twofold, really. First of all, I use the centre-back example all the time, and Ian said, what we're looking for in this centre-back? Well, first of all, they've got to be quick, because they want to defend 1v1 in half a pitch. Second of all, they've got to be strong and dominant in the air, because that's League One. And then third of all, they've got to be able to handle the ball. Well, that's Van Dijk. So I don't, it's easier said than done. But, you know, once we can identify some of those things that, you know, do fit what we're doing, and then obviously the trust of Ian being and his coaching staff being able to develop, you're never going to get the best player to be able to fit all those criteria, or very unlikely, in League One. That's just the way it works. But we know that there are certain tools that we can work with. The second then curse part of it, which is a blessing really, is when we first joined and started working together, we, and obviously then we're able to achieve promotion thanks to Ian's January, was, you know, we had an opportunity then to improve the squad, you know, through promotion. And there were areas of the squad and positions that we could easily identify players that were better than the ones we lost, for instance. Whereas now that gap's getting smaller. So the opportunity, you know, you're looking for, like Ian said previously, the smaller details of where we can improve in really specific areas. And obviously, because we're in a small enough pool already, that becomes harder. And that's why we're now taking more and more time to make sure we're doing more and more due diligence, that the ones we do invest in and bring in, they are adding those bits that we feel that are missing in the squad. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've found this window a different challenge to what we've had in the past, but it, you know, it doesn't mean that it's going to be any less successful. We've got to just make sure we take the time to make the right decisions, and I think that's something we've been really good at.
I followed you when you were at Barrow, Ian, and I remember they called him Barrow Salona, didn't they, because of the style.
He's got a mug, haven't you?
Yeah, I've kept that, yeah.
All right, someone got your mug with that.
Yeah, it says, Football Club de Barrow. I think it's trademarked. By Barcelona. But no, obviously, when you get comparisons like that, it means that people are enjoying what you're trying to do, and that's why we're in the game, really.
And where did you kind of decide that was going to be the style of play you wanted?
So over the course of my playing career, really, you pick up things that you like and what you don't like. You know, everyone laughs because I was a 6'4" centre-back whose strengths were being physically and aerially dominant. And if no one would think that I was an in-possession coach or manager, it's just how you perceive people when you look at them, which is maybe a lesson.
Yeah.
But what I enjoyed as a player was playing football. And look, I'm a self-confessed football snob. I have to be honest and real about that. But that doesn't mean to say I don't respect other methods or other ways to win. Football is about winning at the end of the day, and it doesn't matter how you play. No one remembers that if you lose. No. So it is about winning. But if you can win playing this way, for me, it's the golden chalice, the holy grail. The best in the game do it this way. So that was the way that I want to do it. I wanted to attack with the ball, and I wanted to attack without the ball. And that means being the best in both departments, and also now dominating transitions as well, which there's a lot of detail in that, and a lot of coaching required, especially at this level. But as I said, I do think if you can get it right, then it is sustainable to have success throughout every division of the English pyramid, and that's what we want to do. We're in it to compete. We might not be going from A to Z really quick, but what we are doing is hitting B, C, D, E, F along the way. It's a process. It's okay having ambition and goals, but what are the small steps that you're going to take to make sure you reach and achieve those goals? That's kind of the process we're undertaking at the moment.
And I think a lot of English coaches have been influenced heavily by Pep Guardiola and in that style of play. Did your kind of aims predate him, though, or were you influenced yourself?
Listen, I'm hugely influenced by Guardiola. For me, he's the best, but now, obviously, De Zerbi's come on the scene and you know, we're taking things from him and trying to apply them into what we do. Klopp, the same with his out-of-possession strategy. That's what coaching is. No one's invented the game. I think that's really important to say, or reinvented the game. The game is the game. How you see the game is obviously down to your individual opinion. You know, football is subjective. People like different things. But what I will say is coaching is about taking things from different people and then implementing them into your own style and ideas. You know, Guardiola was influenced by Cruyff.
Mm.
So we mustn't forget that, that, you know, Pep has an influence as well. Cruyff had an influence as well. That's the game. That's how it works. So, if you like a certain thing, then obviously learn off the best and then try and create your own ideas off what they're doing. You know, Pep is a genius and he changes things every season, but he doesn't just sit at home and think, I'm going to reinvent the game. He'll look at opposition the same as everyone else does. He'll look at other ideas and other coaches and think, how does that and how can that relate to me and apply to my team? That's what I do, and hopefully it gets us some success along the way.
I went to your friendly against Curzon Ashton last week. So I did identify a lot of that, you know, playing through the thirds, interchanging at positions, it seemed, particularly in the forward areas, the pressing as well. And I noticed that you were shouting zone one when you're out of possession sometimes. Yeah. What did that mean?
So what I like to do is split the pitch into five zones. So zone one being the outside channel, zone two, zone three being the middle, then zone two and back to zone one. And obviously our pressing strategy, without giving too much away, is basically trying to force the ball into zone one and then keep the ball in zone one, because that's the outside of the pitch and far away from our goal. You know, that's our aim, and it's just really a message to the players and a trigger to know that that's, you know, what we're trying to do, funnel the ball into zone one and then make sure we keep it there, trying to regain the ball as high as we possibly can.
And that's your own kind of way of splitting up the pitch, is it? Because people have different terms, don't they?
100%. Again, people will have a similar and same idea, but the terminology just might be different. You You know, that's just the way it is. Everyone speaks about modern day phrases and terminology, transition being one, but transition is just second balls. You know, that's the old way of saying it. As I said, the game hasn't changed. It's just as along the way, people have been maybe more articulate with the way they explain things.
Yeah. Actually, I was talking to a mate on the way up who's a Bolton fan, and he was saying maybe you have been hindered in a way by being perceived. I did a story about, and someone said, oh, he looks like a right lad. But that, like you say, people can make perceptions based on superficial things, can't they?
100%. And as I said, my playing career was my playing career. I loved being a football player, but I'm much better at this, and that's the truth, and that's how I feel personally. And you know, I played in every division, scored in every division, was promoted out of every division, so I had a pretty good career, and I know what football looks like. But I do enjoy this a lot more. I find it a lot more rewarding, and I do think I'm better at it. So long may that continue.
And in terms of recruitment then, Chris, what is the general process? Because we have a lot of discussion about this on the website. Do you start with data and video and then you deploy the scouts, or how does
that work? It's a good question. I think it's easy to be labelled, like when you hear that somebody uses data, people are then really quick to assume that that means you don't look at video. That for me couldn't be further from the truth. And if you're using data without referring it back to video or watching things with your eye, then you're getting it wrong, and that's a hill that I'll definitely die on. I think it's got to be a balanced approach. I think if we can use data to point back to better things to look at and create better discussion and use that evidence in our decision making, then that's what we want to do. We're doing things slightly differently here in that we try and collect our own data. So we use certain third party data, but we don't have any huge contracts with many of the big providers at the moment. It's something that we want to expand into as we get up the pyramid. But we made a decision when I arrived that we were going to try and do things differently. And with my experience of working that way at the FA, we were able to, you know, get a lot of support, as I said earlier, from the board to really back this way. So we'll collect our own data, both scouting and watching games, and subjective data from people watching, to try and assess the different metrics that Ian needs. But also then we'll try and use that some objective data, some event level data as well, that we think is specific to how we work, and we code some more detail. So we're basically trying to balance it as much as possible. But I would say the perception and some of the things that you see in here online, that we are data, we only use data to recruit, couldn't be further from the truth. And particularly, you know, I think it's around how you translate that. And ultimately, I see part of my job when it comes to data as being the translator. You know, we have a really excellent team of analysts in the recruitment team. We have a data analyst. We use a lot of, like I'm saying, you know, bespoke metrics. But if I come and deliver that way, in those numbers in a way that Ian and the coaching staff don't understand, or I can't relay that to the board, then it's meaningless. So it's my job is really to translate that information and put that into some evidence that I can give to Ian to help make the right decision. So that's something that, yeah, data's involved, doesn't really start or end the process. It's throughout the process. And I think that's something that's important when, you know, we've just been discussing obviously all sorts of different ways you can be a sporting director or technical director. And when data comes up, I don't think it should be a separate department. I think it should be part, you know, that use of data and evidence-based decision-making should be a theme that runs through every department. And particularly that's something we strive for in football. I think there's a lot of clubs that will say and spend a lot of money on data, and I know this, and don't have any impact with it. And it's almost just a sticker to put on the door that everyone thinks they use data, so they think they're forward thinking. For me, if we're spending all this time doing it and it's not impacting Ian's decision making, we may as well stop. So I think that's one thing. That the second thing, when we sat down after knowing we shared the same view of the game, was, and you know, I was guilty of it. Like when I first met Ian, I was working for clubs who had been against his teams. I knew what he was like. I'd spoken to people who knew him, and I did not expect someone so forward thinking and open minded. And those two things made me realise quickly that this is something that I can't and won't pass up, and want to make it work. And I think one of the main things around that is Ian's use and open-mindedness to using data across a you know, a range of topics and departments. And I think that's full credit to him and his coaching staff. You know, we have a really good culture of analysis within the coaching staff, and that's not just the analysts. In fact, that's far from just the analysts, which is really, you know, which is really good.
Would the first step be that the two of you would sit down then, and you might say, Ian, I want to write back with these attributes, and then you would go off and compile a shortlist?
Pretty much. I mean, that's probably missing out a few parts, but basically that's the outline of the conversation. I think while we're at this level, what we've had to do is kind of reevaluate how we build squads. That I'm not going to get a midfielder that can do it all. So we need different personnel with different skill sets to provide, you know, when we're picking teams against certain opposition, it gives me different options. You're not going to get, like you said, the Van Dijk centre back. We might get a centre back that has electric pace and can deal with duels and 1v1s, which is great for, I don't know, a Burton away. But when we're at home against Burton and we're going to completely dominate the ball, if this lad's no good in possession and he's not going to have too much defending to do in large spaces, then it might be a different,
you know,
profile that we need to select. So that's kind of the way we work and the way we think, which means we might have two completely different right backs. We might have one that's really good in the final third, one that has really good speed, you know, or we might have one that's more technical, can receive deeper, can build and combine, you know, those types of things is what we look at.
Yeah, totally. I think that's a really important point to make. And that's also not to say we don't have people that we feel can tick a lot of those boxes. You know, I think it's doing a disservice to our centre-backs to say they can't do all the things that we've said. And it's about, obviously, that consistency. And when, you know, I think we've proven that we are able to tick a lot of those boxes with a lot of the lads. But it's about, that's credit to our, as a club's development in them and their willingness to want to improve as well. We aren't going to buy the finished article, but we want to buy players who might become closer to a finished article.
You know, my role as a manager is not only to get results on a Saturday, but also to improve players and to coach and develop players. And, you know, I'm very passionate about that. Mm. What I find the most rewarding thing is seeing game plans come to life on a Saturday, seeing individuals progress and improve their whole round game. You know, that really does give me a lot of pleasure.
Something we spoke about when we're actually in this room when we first met was, like, about recruitment. And it was around, if you sit down and we've just met a player today, like, people often think, right, we've recruited him, we've got him in the door. Right, he's in the door now. Whereas we talk about re-recruiting players every day, how are we wanting to inspire them to come on this journey with us so that they want to improve and get better. And that's something that Ian and his staff are really good at. And I think that's getting round now. You know, we had particularly last year with the high profile loans of Connor Bradley and James Trafford in particular, who were excellent and excelled for us. I think people can see that it's not just words. You know, I think we've done that. We've also improved, you know, over the journey since Ian's been here, the age and profile of our squad now. We want to build an asset value as well as having good players. We've got young, hungry players. All of our players that we want to sign, we try and look for the ones who are hungry and the ones who, like we, want to do is get to the Championship. So whether that's a player who's played at the Championship and maybe not got then as much game time as they'd like, that willingness and drive to want to get there, whether that's a young loanee it's his first loan, really wants to prove to his parent club he can play at that level. You know, there's loads of different, everyone has their own reason for wanting to be successful, but we look for the ones that have got a real point to prove. And I think that served us well, rather than, you know, some of the more household names who fans might be more familiar with, who have already played at the top level. Of course, they can bring things to us. And we take that very much into account about leadership and personality. But where's the balance between that and someone who's really hungry to go and prove and succeed and make a better life for them and their family? Like, that's the discussions that we have a lot.
That psychological aspect can be hard to scout for, can't it, really? Because I know we did a piece with Lee Bromby, director of football at Huddersfield, and when they met a player, they would have the meeting on an office in an industrial estate. It was quite hard to get to, they said. And they were kind of trying to weed out the people who weren't willing to go the extra mile. And they wanted someone that reflected what the team was about, you know, as well.
I mean, character is a completely different conversation. There's so much that I can say about, you know, characters. And in particular, the way the game has changed, young players now have a real problem with dealing with adversity, aren't very resilient, and we have to coach them in a completely different way to the more experienced players. So I was very fortunate with that, in that as I transitioned through my playing career, I was a captain of most clubs I played for. I did see that shift in personality between the senior players and the young players, and how I used to have to deal with the younger players really helped me develop a way of coping with the players, the modern day player now, the young players who do have problems with criticism. There's the difference between criticism and feedback is just the way you interpret it. It's as simple as that, and it's making sure the players have an open mind to receiving feedback and not taking it personal and not taking criticism. It's about being better and about how we win on a Saturday. That's the one question we always ask ourselves, is this way of acting, is this way of performing going to help us win on a Saturday? Because the most important thing is us winning and improving on a Saturday. So it's having players that will buy into that culture. And I think aside of all the technical detail we're speaking about today, the one thing that we've improved the most on, and we think we are doing things differently at this football club, is the culture. And the way we treat players off the pitch. The owner is absolutely magnificent with that. Sharon is an amazing person, and mental health and well-being is really topical nowadays. And as I said, I never had the help and support as a player that our players get now, and it's something we take a lot of pride in.
I know, so we're talking about Dele Alli, weren't we, obviously last week, and the problems he had, and maybe his managers didn't know about all of that. But you still need to be able to give that clean feedback, don't you? Like you say, you can't hold back if something needs to be said.
No, 100%. But it's managing is the same in any business across the world. You have to be a leader, and your staff have to want to work for you. So you have to identify different characteristics in people and then use that to motivate them. People are motivated by different things, whether it's money, fame, trophies. You have to understand that pretty quickly as a manager, and then use that to try and get the best out of them. But as I said, having an open mind to feedback is probably the most difficult thing to achieve with young players nowadays.
Yeah, and that, I think that's important as well, around the communication and how you deal with that. Ian there discussed obviously like receiving the information, but there's obviously a lot of thought that goes into how you deliver information as well, and different people respond to different ways of communication, whether that be for learning or for feedback. And I think you see more now, you know, it's shifting more towards video meetings, one-to-one, you know, being able to send content online and things like that, because of, you know, the way that the world is now. You know, I've got a 2 and 2 year old daughter who can use an iPad, like it's absolutely mad. So, you know, we have to be conscious of that, and that's something that we often speak about as well. And it is about, as well as how they receive the information, I think we've got to be and are cognizant of how we deliver it so that they can receive it better. And that will be different for everyone. And that's why, you know, I think if we like treat everyone the same is not, I don't think, you've got to treat everyone fairly, but yeah, don't treat everyone the same, because they aren't the same
100%.
Thing.
100%. And I think what we try to do is, this isn't a dictatorship. This is, you know, open conversations, frank, honest discussion, heated debate sometimes. Players I've found now want as much information and detail as physically possible because of the era we live in, social media, you know, iPads, iPhones, you can see so much. You know, these types of conversations we're having today, I've listened to loads of your stuff, and it's really fascinating and interesting, and players listen to this stuff as well, and, and they're keen to challenge you as a coach and a manager, and I welcome that challenge, embrace that challenge, because providing you've got the answers, it's great, you know. It's really good that we are pushing each other and striving to be better every day, and that is a two-way street. It's not just me challenging the players to be better, they, you know, have to challenge me as well, and that's something I'm extremely passionate about.
Our podcast sponsor, Huddle, can help change the way you see the game. More than 35,000 football teams across the world use their Pro Suite tools to combine video and data into powerful insights and winning strategies via one connected platform. Huddle also offers consultancy services for high-performance sport, with world-class experience and expertise in data management, player recruitment, and head coach search. For more information, go to huddle.com/TGG podcast.
Why do you think players aren't as resilient then, or young people in general?
I just think it's just a society thing. I think the way, you know, education system's gone, parenting has gone, and some of it, rightly so, by the way. But the days of, you know, people up against the wall or throwing teacups or coffee,
the old school
shouting, screaming, swearing, just doesn't have any impact on young players nowadays. No. They want detail. Mm. They want to know that they're being improved and being coached. And again, the delivery piece is something that's really, really important.
I think they've got access to more information now. Like, I think the internet, without getting too deep and philosophical, the internet now, they can go out and see, you know, go and watch YouTube tactical analysis of the top managers and top players and in their position, and go and have more information on how to sleep better, how to look after themselves. So they are in a position to challenge more. Whereas back in the day, maybe there wasn't that information readily available, so they took what was being told as a given. I think in terms of the resilience piece, I think social media and a lot of these people have been on social media, and I'm on social media, it's you've got to have a thick skin, because ultimately now you're in a back then you weren't really in a position where you could be sat at home and someone could be feeding direct messages or tweets or whatever straight into you, and if you're reading it, that goes in, and I think that can severely impact people's mental health.
Absolutely. I mean, social media is a completely different topic, but I think what as a player and as a manager and a coach, you have to accept that you're not going to be everybody's cup of tea. Even our own fans, you know, some of them won't like the way that we play, and that's absolutely fine. You have critics with everything you do, and you know, I said to Chris the other day, I found a quote from Margaret Thatcher that
Kirk Cousins
said, and he
NFL
said,
quarterback.
Yeah, if my critics saw me walk on water, they'd think it's because I can't swim. And that's just the nature of the beast. It's football. Mm. And we just have to accept that, but be really clear and positive with what we're trying to do. And most important, believe in it. If I didn't believe in what we do and the way we play, how the hell am I going to get any players to believe in it?
Mm.
So come rain or shine, you know, whether we're winning on a Saturday or losing, we stick to our process, we stick to our beliefs, and we judge ourselves on that process and our beliefs. And I think fundamentally we've seen some significant improvement over the 3 years we've been here.
Yeah, and I think in terms of that, the whole piece on the insecurity thing, and you know what we've just been discussing, it's not to say that every one of the young players is like that, but the resilience does seem to be less, and like I say, it's not saying that's across the board, but you know, I think that's something that we're mindful of, particularly, you know, and as more of this generation, you know, there'll be more of the players making it through to be in that first team environment. And I think that's where things like the under-23s and PL2 has been, you know, good in trying to bridge that gap. But we've tried to do things a bit of a different way, maybe with our B team, and play them against more, you know, for instance, senior opposition. So I'm not just talking about now resilience off the field, talking about resilience on the field as well.
100%. And I think one of my biggest assets as a coach manager is that I have modern day methods and methodology, but I carry the old school values, and it's about how you combine the two to get the best out of the modern day player.
Yeah, I think something that came across from the old school that I hear is maybe it wasn't as thoughtful as it could have been. I don't know what you found as a player, and that you wouldn't have had the discussions, you wouldn't have been asked your opinion. It would be more sort of command and control, dictatorship. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly that, and I think the game has progressed so much. Mm. I mean, I was playing in the Premier League 13 years ago for a team that didn't want to do a session with any out-of-possession strategy. You know, we didn't know who to press, when to press, what the triggers were to press. We didn't have any meetings about opposition, no oppo analysis. You know, we were Blackpool going to Man United away in the Premier League, just backing what we do with the ball and not really having an out-of-possession plan, which nowadays I find baffling. As I said, it doesn't matter what your strategy is. It is about winning. But what I will say about modern-day coaching is everybody has a plan.
Yeah,
regardless of that plan or what it looks like or how detailed it is, everybody has a plan and they coach to that plan. So I think the game's improved tenfold.
We had Simon Wilson on a webinar from Stockport County, and the level of detail, again, in their 7-year plan was unbelievable. you know, and that's in was in non-league. Yeah. So
I think that's a good, come an important thing to say is particularly it's got, it probably started in the top half of the Premier League, and each of the last, you know, each year it probably goes down a few places, and now, like you say, we're right down to non-league. People have the opportunity to, you know, express their, how they want to play, however that is, and like you say, have a plan, buy players to play that plan, and coach players, then you've got a chance of being successful. That's the beauty of the game, why we all love it. There's no divine right to do anything. So we know we've got to try and work harder, smarter, but, you know, that's the thing that we discuss a lot. Like, in the past, maybe, like, if you did good opposition detail and you had a plan, maybe you'd have a big advantage over everybody else. So the ones that took it on sooner did get an advantage. Now we speak about all the time, like, we've got to be, when we're doing our game plans, we've got to be aware that they're watching us the same as we're watching them. You know, it's not just us doing opposition analysis. It's not just us that wants to win every Saturday. It's every and Tuesday. It's everybody else. Yeah.
And I think the key words there are hard and smart. There's no good working 15, 16, 17 hours a day if you're not working smarter than everybody else. It's how you use that time to improve, which is really important. And I think, you know, as I'm getting more experience as a manager, I'm learning what works and what doesn't. It will tell you that. Now, I spend my life watching football, looking at football, thinking about how I improve both as a manager but and as a person. And I think that is also part of my role, is to improve the players as people as well. And yeah, it's not always about the hours you put in. It's about what you do in those hours of work. And yeah, all the time we're becoming more and more educated with that.
What's coming across there that you're talking about is developing relationships as well with the players. Are there any kind of tips for that, or is it just human skills and putting the time and effort in?
I think that's it. I think it's people skills. Again, it's understanding their characters. One thing I am is I'm pretty intense. When it comes to stepping over that white line and onto the grass, whether it be a simple passing drill in a coaching training session or match days, it's business. And there has to be a clear difference between business and pleasure. Off the pitch, you know, I'm a nice guy, my door is always open. I'll help the players in all aspects of their lives, you know, and I'm part of that group and part of their culture. But on the pitch, it's where setting standards and demands come in, and they have to understand the clear difference between what business looks like and then what having a personal relationship looks like off the pitch as well.
I've had a bit of discussion as well with managers about what you actually do on the touchline. And yeah, you're quite vocal, it seems, and quite imposing.
I'm trying to improve. I think I'm loads better than what I was. I think what I found was, because I went straight from playing into managing, I found it really difficult in not having any direct impact on the games. So I felt by shouting or arguing with the opposition or with referees, it gave me some involvement in the game. Now I'm becoming a lot more relaxed. I mean, people will probably still laugh at that, but from where I was 5 years ago, it's chalk and cheese. And just understanding that, looking myself in the mirror and saying, look, my work is done. I know to the best of my ability, I prepared the players as well as I can. Now it's over them. You know, I've drawn the outline. It's up to them to go out and paint the picture. And yeah, the understanding of that is something I'm improving on all the time.
I think it was really interesting though, when you speak about when you first became a manager and you wanted to directly impact it, even though it was at Barrow, there were crowds there. I think there was then a period, obviously, when I first joined here, and football and COVID was a totally different time.
Yeah.
And you could impact more from the side because everyone could hear you. So I think you then went through a period where you could impact.
Yeah.
And then the crowds came back in, you couldn't impact again.
Yeah, that's
so true. It's trying to have that understanding, like you say, now that's where we really want, you know, to develop. Once you go over that line, you want the players to take over. And that, like when you were saying earlier about asking their input and asking them to, that's why, because they're the ones that have got to solve a problem on the field in seconds.
Absolutely. Half time and full time to have any impact for me is too late.
Yeah.
If you know what we're finding now, the better reputation that we're gaining along the way is teams will change for us. It doesn't matter how much analysis we do, we can formulate a game plan based on what they've done in the last 5, 6, 7 games, but they could come here and completely change. So it's the players finding that and having the solutions to know that, well, if the opposition do this, then we do this. If they do that, then we do that. And that's, again, my job as a manager, to make sure they understand all of that. because, like I said, half time or full time is just too late.
Yeah, it's interesting that touchline one, because I know Klopp got asked about it and he said, I'm the energy of the team, and they'll look to me for an example if I need to 100%. Pump them up. If, you know.
Everybody needs a spark, and sometimes the spark doesn't come from the players. Mm. The managers might sense that they need to be re-energised. Fans need to be energised. Yeah. And whether that be, sometimes the biggest thing that energises fans, and I think it's just the British culture thing, is feeling hard done to or hard done by. If it's a bad decision or
a bad tackle,
yeah. it's kind of revs everyone up and re-energises them. But how do we do that without those instances? Sometimes that can be the manager. And the way they act on the touchline.
And I know at Curzon Ashton, James Trafford was there in the crowd. So a loan's very important. And like, how did that one come about?
Yeah, loans are really important. Obviously, I think it's first of all to say that if we had the opportunity to own an asset versus loan one and develop someone else's, we'd always want to develop our own. That's the same as everyone. It's not a secret, but it's important to say. And obviously, you know, we're in a geographically here at Bolton, we're in a really good location to tap into some of the, you know, the big heavyweights in the Premier League. And we've done well with that. We've created good relationships. And like I said earlier, it's about the proofs in the pudding. We can say, look, this is how we play. And I think one thing that, you know, when we speak about the benefits of Ian's playing style is, you know, that it is similar to the ones at the top of the game. So we can say to a Man United, Liverpool, Manchester City player, that if you come here, you're going to have very similar experiences on the field to what you might have to have there. You know, there's a huge pressure to win here. There'll be a huge pressure to win at their clubs. We're going to dominate the ball quite a lot. We're going to dominate the ball at their clubs. So in terms of giving the players relevant experiences to what they might come up against if they want to play for Man City, Liverpool, Man United and the rest, I think that's something that we've done really well in terms of that one with Traff in particular. I think it was a different one compared to a lot of the others, because people forget he'd just gone out to Accrington and it was his first loan and things didn't go well for him and he wasn't in the team at Accrington. And I know, I remember the day we signed him, the reaction from some parts of the fan base was not positive, yeah. Let's say. But, you know, in that one, in, you know, in particular, you know, it's about research and networking. I was lucky that obviously I worked at the FA, know people like Tim Dittmer, who's huge help to me and to us. People trying to tap into those relationships to say, right, what is his mentality like? We talk about his resilience had to be, you know, so high to come from Accrington under that pressure to play in front of 20,000 on his debut. And we had some assurances that he was very, very good technically, a great person, and had that resilience. So, you know, in each one's different. Conor Bradley, again, was totally different to that. He's one we've been monitoring through Ian's contacts and our work on the player. And we knew that that was one, if we could get him, we were going to do it, because we would find it very difficult to own someone who could do those things for us. So each one's slightly different. But, as a premise, they're important, but it certainly isn't. We don't want to become a feeder club for the bigger teams either. So it's getting the balance right.
Mm. 100%. And James is, you know, I said this to James on that evening that we just discussed at Curzon, that he's just the first one, you know, to see him go on and develop. It's a great marker for us to say, right, James was the first loan player that we took on, and 18 months later is now going to become, well, he's a household name all of a sudden from the 21s. We want all of our players to achieve that. That's the dream, really. And yeah,
it's James. It's been important as well when we're looking for his replacement. You know, Nathan Baxter, who's a player who's played most of his recent football in the Championship, but he looks at the development we were able to help James with, and his attitude has been fantastic since he's come in, and that, yeah, do you know what? I love what you've done with him. I think I can go to those heights. He'll back himself to go even further. So what I'm saying is, not just the parent clubs, if we show we can develop people and also players, then they're going to hopefully want to come and join us, and that gives us an opportunity to widen our pool of talent to get people who, you know, we might not get otherwise.
And that's the thing. I mean, the big clubs now are becoming a lot more intelligent with where they place players.
Mm-hmm.
But Chris makes a great point there about doing similar things here to what they do at the parent clubs. Most people will take the lazy route and say, well, we want him to go and play the Championship.
The highest level possible. Yeah.
It doesn't matter what club or what level that is. If it's higher than what we're at, then we'll send him there. Well, what happens if it's going to a Championship club that's just been promoted from League One, that's going to be up against it every week,
no
going to have 35% possession? you know, for an attacking player, for instance, he's never going to receive the ball in the areas that he would for us 30 to 40 times a game.
Mm-hmm.
He's never going to be having the same pressure of expectancy to win, you know, playing in front of huge crowds. It's how their loans directly translate to what they're trying to do at the parent clubs.
And that's why at the opposite end of the spectrum, like, it's so specific, like the level, you know, we obviously aren't at this level with our B team yet, but when you look at these big clubs, the amount of players they have in the loans departments, like that's that the example you described there as an attacker might be the exact opposite for a goalie. They might want the goalie to go to a, probably will want to go to goalie to go somewhere who's going to be busy, experience loads of shots on target. So I think the strategy of it is really interesting and important.
And that, I mean, I was a centre-back, but as centre-backs now, it's really, really most difficult position for these big Cat 1 teams, especially around the Northwest, to develop centre-backs, because they never have to defend. They're always dominating the ball.
Mm-hmm.
They never have to head the ball anymore, for instance. There's no duels. There's no aerial duels. They don't have to come up against direct pressure. They'll only find that by going out on loan to the lower leagues. But it's that snobbery of, well, I'm not going to play in League Two. You know, I'm 20 grand a week Man City centre-back. Why should I have to go through that? Well, it's better for your development, that's why.
Yeah.
And I think people are starting to realise that now.
Yeah, when we were when I was at the FA, when there was a period of time where every one of the back four and goalie had played either in League Two or certainly had been brought through a top club, basically. You know, people like John Stones, Kyle Walker.
There's no coincidence, Harry Maguire. They've all played Championship or below.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's important in terms of that. And like Ian says, you know, we were looking at lone centre-backs at the beginning of last season, and there was one that we really like. We watched him, must have been over a dozen times in Premier League 2, managed to go and, you know, get some footage and go through it again. And no joke, watched 12 games, didn't see him have one contested aerial duel. And we knew our first home game, or one of the first home games of the season, was Wickham, and Sam Vokes would have eaten him alive.
Yeah.
So we can't do it. You know, very good on the ball, excellent pace, and all the other stuff that we liked. But it's around how, for them, it must be, how do they get them that? And like I say, it's so specific for each position. It really is. I understand why there's some of these big loan departments at the bigger clubs. It really, really is important.
Would James Trafford have had to go to that game against Curzon Ashton? Or did he choose?
Oh, no, he's not.
He's nothing to do
with us anymore. Right, so he did that for a social perspective.
He just loves... I mean, again, that speaks volumes for does. How we treated him.
Yeah.
Again, it's a two-way street. He was brilliant for us, but people must remember we were also brilliant for him.
Mm.
And again, it just speaks volumes for our culture and environment that he wants to come back and spend time with us, with us all.
Yeah.
He was saying if he doesn't get into one of the international squads, which is ridiculous to even think he won't, but he's going to come to one of the away days and sit in the away end with all the Bolton fans. That sums it up.
Yeah. I mean, I messaged him immediately after the final just saying I was really proud of him, and, you know, he's so humble that he just said, you know, I'm so proud of you for what you did for me, and, you know, how we developed him as a person and as a player. He's reaping the rewards for that. And as I said, he's a great example and a shining light to all of our other young players.
Are you keen on having the transition from your academy into the first team? I know the academy's had some issues, hasn't it, in recent years because, you know, funding and what's happened with the club. But is that something you foresee?
Everyone wants to develop their own, but that's a really difficult thing to do, especially being where we are right now. It's had years of decline, really, the academy. We're having to rebuild the whole thing. We're in the Northwest, and the way the system is at the moment, it's fundamentally broken to be able to develop your own talent from the age of 8, for instance, through to 16. I think, you know, the rules for the big Cat 1 teams to come and take our best 8-year-olds is the compensation is virtually zero.
Yeah.
So it's a really, really challenging thing to do. However, on the flip side of that is we're in a really good position where we're situated to get the best 16-year-olds that have been released from Man City, Man United, Liverpool to come and play for us and with us. They might not be good enough for them at that stage, but they'll certainly be good enough for us. So because of our geographical location, we can pick up some rough diamonds too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like you say, same as the rest of the club, there had been, you know, it had gone into decline. You know, it got to the point where we were down into a Cat 3 academy, and that meant we didn't have an under 21s team. And we got to, you know, we knew, like I said, it's going to be difficult for us to create a team, you know, the golden generation where we get 10 players into the first team. I mean, it doesn't happen even at the very, very top, and they're spending millions and millions and millions. So for us, we were still getting, you know, 2, 3, 4 players, and we do each year through our academy. And I think, you know, with some of the improvements we're making throughout that, with people like Dave Garner and Matt Craddock and others, we're going to get, you know, hopefully that number will increase per age group. But we've had players where they've got to that point, and for instance, Max Conway is one we talk about being with us since, you know, the ages we mentioned. Is he ready now for Bolton Wanderers first team? Well, the answer's no, but that's not a slight on him because he was 18. But if we discard him, will he go on and have a career in the Football League and potentially Championship and higher? Well, the answer is yes. So what our decision was, what environment do we want to create to allow our young players time to develop? And, you know, you look now at some of the other, you know, the other B teams and, you know, players, it's getting to the age of 22, 23 before they're ready to play in the parent club's first teams, and they have different loans and experiences. And that's something that we made a conscious decision to go down with the B team rather than go into a Cat 2 for the moment, was we wanted to try and do things a bit differently, create a different game schedule and games programme. Like I said, we had 1 year, 1 week last year, which was, you know, a brilliant week where we played in the Central League against Accrington on the Wednesday, and it was a real good battle, always is against Accrington, you know, man for man press, aggressive, we're trying to play through it, physical game. Then we played a non-league team on Saturday morning because their game had been cancelled, men's team, you know, some of our 17-year-olds playing against 34, 35-year-olds. And we held our own in that game physically and tactically. I think we won that game. And then we went to Carrington to play a friendly against United on the Wednesday because it was international break, and we played against Sancho and Garnacho for 90 minutes. Yeah, right, so you think of the left back, what he's faced in 7 days,
yeah,
is something, you know, a huge amount of learning and experiences that have gone into that. So I think when we speak about doing things differently, that was part of thinking behind the B team, and also being able to use our, like Ian says, our location to our advantage to be able to recruit some of those ones that, whether it's 16 and then go through the youth team with us, or even ones that have, you know, missed the youth team. We've got Conor Carty, a young Irish striker from Wolves. He's now just got in he's out in Ireland playing for St. Pat's, and he's just got in the Ireland under-21 squad. So we've got an under-21 international striker on our books through having that time and giving him time to develop. And if he makes it here, who knows? But we're giving him a chance, and I think as we improve our methods, and, you know, a huge part of that is aligning all the playing style in the academy to what it takes to get into Ian's team, because it's hard to get in there.
Southampton have actually scrapped their B team because they're saying it was just the under-21s, basically. It was in the under-21s league. There's no point branding it a B team, but yours is a proper...
Yeah, ours is separate.
I think it gives us the flexibility, as Chris said, to play against under-21 teams, but also get them some real development time against men's teams, non-league men's teams, where sometimes learning to use your body in different ways. Dion Charles is a great example with his playing journey. You know, started at Blackpool, was released, went through non-league.
He's a winger.
And for someone so diminutive, small size, uses his body tremendously well. And he's only learnt that from being on a journey in the non-league.
Yeah, really good point.
And have Y Scout and Huddle help then with the B team in terms of footage and
across all our processes in terms of analysis and review. But as you mentioned there, Y Scout, you know, we're able to pick our games and send them to Y Scout for them to be able to add on there. That's multifunctional for us. Obviously, it gives us clips and gives us a resource to use with players, but also, you know, we now need to think about, as we spoke about, us helping Man City's players and loans. We want to put them on that platform so that if we say to someone, you know, we think you should have a look at Nelson Kumbeini, then they're able to go on there and see all Nelson's clips. Whereas, you know, we're not, you know, that wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for that on that larger scale. So, yeah, it was a conscious decision to get them involved. But, you know, not just the B team. I think it's really important to say the culture of analysis that we've got here in terms of, look, it's driven by the manager. The manager watches more footage and does more analysis than anybody else. So everyone else is trying to keep up and match his standards. And even, you know, post-match with the first team, win, lose or draw, there is a post-match debrief, and in two game weeks, that's a lot of time and effort, and that's not the same at every club. You know, it might be, you know, it might be, you know, if we win, we'll leave it because that was good, or if we lose 6-0, we'll watch the full 90 minutes. It's not like that here. Ian's extremely, like, consistent with that, but it's around, like I said before, work. It, just because you do the hard work doesn't mean you're doing it better. It's trying to use that smarter and do that. But yeah, in terms of the culture analysis, that comes from me, and that trickles its way down everybody.
I know you actually got name checked, didn't you, by Rob Edwards after the playoff final because the work you'd done on penalties at the FA.
Yeah. Was. We've always had a bit of a laugh about penalties, Ian and I, in terms of since I came here and some discussions on that. But look, yeah, it was, that was something I was lucky to be involved in. My previous role was something that, yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity. Able to really, you know, be at the front of something like that. My job was basically to answer performance questions for the England coaches, whether that be men's, women's, down the pathway, using data and analysis to try and provide some answers to specific football related questions. And the first one, obviously, that Gareth came up with was how, obviously very, very personal to him, was how to win a penalty shootout. And lucky enough, given a blank canvas again, to go away and come up with a piece of research that did that. Look, it's not to say that as well it's guaranteed, because that's the thing. There is going to be an element of luck involved in every part of football, and that's no different. But for penalties, again, and the same with everything, if you can reduce the risk by doing some certain things well, and giving people the tools to be able to try and perform in those skills under pressure, then that was basically what it was, and taking ownership of you know, the skill, which is to try and score a penalty. So the fact that we were able to influence so many people, you know, Rob worked in our pathway, Steve Cooper was involved, Paul Simpson obviously won a penalty shootout on the same weekend, and yeah, it was a you know, piece of work that I was really proud to be involved in. Obviously the main idea was to win a World Cup shootout, and that Colombia game, we managed to do that. So yeah, it was a really exciting time.
And I'll just ask each of you a question each before we draw to a close. For you, first of all, Chris, what are the ambitions for Bolton in the next few seasons?
Yeah, look, I think we've outlined and gone through that already. We want sustainable success, and I think that's the hardest thing to achieve in any walk of life, because, you know, if we think we might have slightly overachieved in the last couple of seasons, well, that now becomes the norm, and the pressure that comes with that we've got to live up to. And, you know, looking for those 1%, not usually a fan of that term, but looking for those marginal gains to improve year on year. And yeah, we know where this club deserves to be, and we'll be doing everything we can to get it back there. But yeah, sustainable success, and looking, like Ian said, not just the results, but the processes behind it, so that when we do get into the Championship, we're in a position to thrive and not survive.
For you, Ian, finally, I know we talked about perceptions, but you are a hot property in management. What are your own personal ambitions?
Obviously, I want to get to the Premier League. I do think I'll get to the Premier League, but again, the processes involved with that, I know, again, I can't go from A to Z without missing every letter in between. This is a process. This is progress. The reason I joined this football club is I didn't want to be a manager that continuously had to move to improve. I wanted to go on a journey together with Sharon, the rest of the board. This football club can take me where I want to go, and vice versa, really. It was a really rare opportunity to get a football club of this size that was completely broken at the bottom of League Two and kind of make it your own. And that's the dream, really, to become the first manager with one football club to go from League Two to the Premier League. That's the aim, that's the ambition. Again, ambition and entitlement are two completely different things, and that's something that this football club in particular, we battle against all of the time, because the fan base has a rich history of playing football in the top divisions. But for us, it's about how we get there and the processes involved with helping us do that sustainably. I love the journey. Really enjoying it, working with Chris and the rest of the people we've managed to get involved, and long may it continue.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Training Ground Guru podcast in association with Huddle. We'll be back next month with another episode. In the meantime, you can follow our latest updates on the website and on Twitter @ground_guru.